There were about 30 guests in the Tabard Inn that evening in 1387. Noisy, happy guests, full of anticipation about the journey they would be making in the morning. The inn was in South London, and many of the guests were locals, though some had come from other parts of England. They had been arriving all day, keeping the stable boys busy, fetching water and hay for the horses, and the serving maids dashing about with mugs of ale and plates of meat from the kitchen. Now, after sunset, they all gathered together in the main room before the fireplace to hear what the landlord had to say. He, too, would be journeying with them, leaving the inn in the care of his wife. The destination of the group was the town of Canterbury, 55 miles away, the religious capital of England and location of the tomb of St. Thomas. 200 years before, in the 1100s, Thomas, more commonly known as Thomas Becket, had been the Archbishop of Canterbury, the highest office in the English Church. Now his tomb was a shrine, and the group that met at the inn was on a pilgrimage to see it. There they would say prayers, ask forgiveness for their sins, and leave a symbolic gift for the saint. Everyone in England tried to make the pilgrimage to Canterbury at least once in their lifetime, and some went many times, but never did they go alone. The road to Canterbury cut through woods that were full of robbers, lying in wait for the travelers and their gifts. The landlord of the inn, who had been to Canterbury before, would serve as the guide for the pilgrims who sat before him this evening, some perched on the edge of wooden benches, others sitting cross-legged on the straw-covered floor, all anxiously awaiting what he had to say. The landlord told them the journey to Canterbury was long and slow, even though it was spring and the weather would be fine and the roads in good condition. To pass the time merrily, he had a plan. To keep themselves amused, each pilgrim would tell 2 tales on the way to Canterbury and 2 more on the way back. The one who told the best tale would be awarded with a splendid dinner when they returned to the inn. The company happily agreed to the plan and began to think about which tales would most delight their companions. The next morning they all mounted their horses and set out on the road to St. Thomas's tomb. They were a colorful group, of all kinds, from many different classes. There was the brave but gentle knight who had fought in the Crusades, his squire or assistant, a handsome lad with rosy cheeks, an honest farmer, a cook, a chubby friar who was especially good at begging, a dainty prioress and a nun, a poor scholar from Oxford who rode a bony horse, a doctor who was something of a quack, a poor but honest parson, a miller, a tax collector, a sailor, a fat, cheerful lady known as the Wife of Bath, a couple of rascals, and finally, a tall man with twinkling eyes and a pointed beard whose name was Geoffrey Chaucer. Chaucer was a man who had served in England's army, was a civil servant, and held prominent positions at the king's court. But most importantly, he was a writer, a poet, and a man who loved good tales. As the pilgrims rode in 2s and 3s along the rutted path to Canterbury, he listened to their stories and remembered them. And when the pilgrimage was over and he returned to London, he wrote down not just the stories, but vivid and clever descriptions of the pilgrims themselves. Chaucer died before he could finish his stories, so we'll never know who won the splendid dinner at the end of the journey. But his book, Canterbury Tales, became a classic of literature that has endured over 600 years. Because of the tales and his other writings, Chaucer is regarded, along with Dante, as the greatest literary figure of medieval times, one of the world's best poets, and in some ways, the creator of the modern English language. Chaucer was born in the year 1340 in a house his father owned on Thames Street in London. At the time, London was still little more than a medieval town. It had 40,000 inhabitants who lived in unsanitary conditions, in ramshackle houses clustered along the River Thames, where they suffered from dampness, cold, and constant illness. The streets and countryside were dangerous because of thieves, and there was political turmoil throughout the land and constant fights over the throne. When Chaucer was only about 8 or 9, the plague, known as the Black Death, swept across England, killing 3 out of 8 people in less than a year and a half. Even the king, Edward III, lost his 15-year-old daughter. Nothing is known of Chaucer's mother, Agnes, but his father, John, was a wealthy wine merchant in London who had influence in court and was able to get Chaucer positions there when he was still quite young. The family at some point ran a leather business. In fact, the name Chaucer comes from the French chaussier, which means maker of footwear. For four generations, the Chaucer family had been steadily rising up through the middle class, so that by the time Geoffrey was born, they were on the edge of the upper class and had many connections with nobility. John Chaucer was prosperous enough to give his son a solid education in the city's grammar schools, and later in the schools at court. He learned to speak and read French and Latin, which were more important at the time than English. French was the official language at court, and Latin was the language of textbooks and scholarly works. Later in life, probably in his 20s, Chaucer may have studied law at Oxford, the usual course for a young man planning a career at court. Chaucer was a civil servant throughout his life and served under three different English kings, Edward III, Richard II, and Henry IV. After elementary school, Chaucer became a page in the household of the royal prince, Lionel, Duke of Clarence, the third son of King Edward. The Duke enjoyed Chaucer's cleverness and sense of humor and began to take him on his travels across the country. During this time, the Hundred Years' War between France and England was still dragging on, so Chaucer, as a squire, went to France in the army headed by the Prince of Wales. It was not the sort of campaign that glorious poems are written about. The weather was bad, provisions were short, and the enemy wouldn't engage in battle. Young Chaucer only had one noteworthy adventure. As he was riding ahead with a small group of scouts, his party was surrounded by the French and taken captive near Reims. Chaucer was about 20 years old at the time. When Edward III learned that one of his bright, favored squires was a prisoner, he paid a ransom of 16 pounds, a large sum of money in those days, for his release. During the peace negotiations that followed the war, Chaucer served as messenger from Calais to England. Because of his services, he was then entered into the king's service as a yeoman of the king's chamber. His responsibilities were to see to the comfort of his royal master and to supervise the servants, pages, and court messengers. As Chaucer grew older, his responsibilities at court increased. He was sent on secret missions for the king to France, Italy, Spain, and Flanders, an area that included today's Belgium. On one of these trips, he went to Genoa and Florence to arrange trade with Italian merchants and negotiate for the use of their ports. On another, he helped negotiate the marriage of Princess Marie of France to Prince Richard, who would later become King Richard II, and on still another, he procured loans for King Edward. But most of his missions were kept so secret that we still don't know their purpose. In Italy, Chaucer felt he'd found a spiritual home. He was inspired by Italian poetry and literature and began to adopt its style into his own work. Even though Chaucer was a trusted messenger and a loyal servant to the king, he was always somewhat carefree and careless. He was given many rewards for his services, and still he was always short of money. He spent most of it on books, wine, fine clothes, and feasting. When Henry IV became king, he granted Chaucer, then 27 years old, a healthy pension of 40 marks a year, worth about 600 pounds today. But only a few days later, Chaucer lost the official document that gave permission for him to withdraw the money from the treasury and had to ask for a second document. Another time, when he was traveling from Westminster to the royal manor outside of London to pay the king's servants, four thieves leapt out from behind an oak tree, snatched his saddlebags, and ran off, leaving him without a cent. Chaucer had to ride back to Westminster, get more money, and set out again. Meanwhile, the same band of robbers had hidden themselves in the woods and probably could hardly believe their luck when the well-dressed man with the money bags came galloping by for the second time in one day. They assaulted him with clubs, knocked him from his saddle, and took the horse as well as the bags. Chaucer returned to Westminster yet again, only this time on foot. Later, when he was reading to the king, as he did every night, he made up a lively tale about his adventures with the highwayman, prompting the king to remark that he'd better find a new messenger, since not only was Chaucer not very good at hanging on to money, but it was unacceptable to the king to have the greatest poet in Europe being cudgeled regularly by the same knaves. When he was 27, Chaucer was made an esquire, a title that comes right below knight. Such officers lived at court and performed important staff duties. He was married by then to a woman named Philippa Pan, the daughter of a knight and one of the damsels of the queen's chamber. Her sister was married to one of the king's sons, so it could be said that Chaucer married well and above the class he'd been born into. Both he and his wife were often given generous grants of money, gifts, and favors from the king, including a rent-free house in London. Poetry and writing were always an avocation to Chaucer, hobbies that filled his free time and satisfied his enormous creative and intellectual interests. He had a particular fascination with science and delved into all the disciplines popular during medieval times, which included astronomy, astrology, alchemy, medicine, dream analysis, and physiognomy, the practice of determining character on the basis of facial features or body structure. He even wrote a book on the astrolabe, an instrument used at the time to measure altitudes and solve problems of astronomy, a forerunner to the sextant. In addition, he translated Latin books on philosophy and some biographies and studied theology. In 1374, when Chaucer was 34, he was appointed Controller of Customs and Subsidy of wools, skin, and hides in the port of London. It was an appointment that paid well, and even better, he could fill it with a deputy, thus leaving him all the free time he needed to write and pursue any other interests he had. 12 years later, he left his rent-free house in London and moved to Kent, where he first served as a Justice of the Peace and then as an elected representative in Parliament. At that point, he became a knight. In spite of all these advances, he was still often broke and in debt. Once in Kent, where Canterbury was located, he began work on the Canterbury Tales, slogging away at it between the years of 1387 and 1400, when he was 47 to 60 years old. It was a sizable challenge, recording over 120 tales and describing the people who told and listened to them, and he never completed it. A year after he started the book, he sold his royal pension for a lump sum to settle a series of lawsuits against him for debts he owed. It seemed no matter how much his salary increased, his spending increased more. While he was working on Canterbury Tales, Chaucer received yet another promotion. This time he was named Clerk of the King's Work by Richard II, who had just ascended to the throne. By now, Chaucer was almost 50. He was 6 feet tall, robust and solid, but his duties as clerk of the king's work must have been hard just the same. They required him to supervise the construction and repairs on royal property and to arrange the labor and payrolls. There was also much travel involved, since the king's property stretched all over England. In spite of these demands and an incredibly busy life in service to the crown, Chaucer managed to steadily produce poetry and books. He also managed to keep knowledgeable and informed. His familiarity with classical literature and his fluency in three languages is evident in everything he wrote. His earliest works were based on French models of writing. His later works reflect an interest in Italian culture and art, including the works of Dante. By now, Chaucer had a family to support, although the exact size of that family is in doubt. Most historians think he had 2 sons and 2 daughters. When he was 51, he dedicated one of his scientific writings to little Lewis, my son, who was then 10 years old. History makes no other references to the boy. But a generation after Chaucer's death, a Thomas Chaucer appears and is called Chaucer's son, proving he had at least 2 children. Thomas was a man of wealth and position, so it seems Chaucer was able to pass something on in spite of his years of financial difficulty. There is also an Elizabeth Chaucer connected to the family, but no one knows if she was Chaucer's daughter. Records show she was established as a nun by one of Chaucer's patrons. Another Chaucer named Agnes shows up now and then and may have been his 2nd daughter, named after his mother. Chaucer's wife probably died in 1387 when he was about 47. In his last years, Chaucer's pension was increased under yet a new king, this time Henry IV. Now he was earning 700 pounds a year plus an annual ton of wine. One of the first things he did with the income was to lease a house in the garden of Westminster Abbey, a location he could only have been granted because of his connections at his court. He was to enjoy this bounty for only a year. Chaucer died in 1400 and was buried on October 25th near his garden in Westminster Abbey, a singular honor for a commoner. He was the first artist buried there, and therefore the founder of its famous Poet's Corner. Ever since, all of England's greatest writers have been honored by burial in the same corner. Chaucer is admired today not just for his artistry, but for his contributions to the English language, a language he, in fact, helped establish. English had its start in what is known as Anglo-Saxon, the oldest form of our current language, but one that today reads more like a foreign language. Here's an example of Anglo-Saxon from the 1100s.
Here on this gear, Willem King Jeff Rodberg, Jarl Thon Jarldom on Northumberland. Da komen the landesmen to gainis him, and hinne aufslogen, and ix hund manna mit him.
Unbelievably, what this really says in our language is, in this year King William gave the Earl Robert the earldom of Northumberland. Then came the men of the country against him, and slew him, and 900 men with him. The most famous work in Anglo-Saxon is Beowulf, which probably dates to the end of the 8th century. But the Anglo-Saxon language continued into the 1100s, 200 years before Chaucer. By the end of the 13th century, it finally began to look somewhat familiar. Chaucer gave us the first English books that we can still read for pleasure today. Although his spelling is mysterious, some of his words are no longer in use, and it takes great concentration to interpret his work. Still, he remains the most beloved of English poets and the creator of our current English language. At the time he wrote, French had long been the language of court, the schools, and the cultural life in Britain, and the country had yet to claim its own national language. It was the example of Chaucer, writing in powerful and humorous language that was considered vulgar at the time, that led later writers to imitate him. That language is now called Middle English. It was in use from about 1100 to 1485, and then steadily evolved into language as we know it today. The structure of Chaucer's work also influenced the history of literature. He was the first poet to use the rhymed five-beat couplet in iambic pentameter called heroic verse, which became basic to our literature. You can hear the familiar rhythms in lines like these from Canterbury Tales. At night was come into that hostelry, well 29 in a company. The Western world owes to Chaucer, then, both the language and the rhymes of most of the poetry written in English. As far as we know, Chaucer's first work was Book of the Duchess, written in 1369 when he was 29 years old. It's a poem of 1,300 lines written on the death of a noble's wife by plague and contains some of his most beautiful and lyrical writing. The poem, which is really an elegy to the Duchess, is written as a dream, an idea he'd adopted from Italian verse. It not only laments the death of the Duchess, but shows much sympathy and compassion for the widower, the Duke of Lancaster, who was a friend and patron of Chaucer's. Another early work, called The Parliament of Fowls, reflects Chaucer's great sense of fun and humor. In this poem, he parodies his contemporaries in a Valentine's Day setting where everyone is choosing their mates. It was based on the myth that each year on Valentine's Day, the birds gathered before the goddess of nature to select a mate. It's thought he wrote the poem to celebrate the engagement of King Richard II to Anne of Bohemia. Even though the characters in the Parliament of Fowls are birds, when a royal eagle quarrels with two other noble birds for the favors of a lady eagle, it's clear Chaucer isn't just talking about feathered lovers. Beneath its playful exterior, he was examining various kinds of human love while also parodying the romances at court. Chaucer often satirized the lofty ideals, elaborate etiquette, and literary style of the aristocracy, even though he was friends with many in that class and did most of his writings for them. He would often read at court to entertain the nobles and the king, but his satire was so gentle and humorous, no one took offense. He also liked to satirize the corruption of the medieval church, but he was less gentle and tolerant in those cases than he was with the court. In fact, there is one report of him being charged with beating a friar in a public street, although what provoked him remains a mystery. He was a religious and pious man himself, who was annoyed by any hypocrisy in churchmen and often included dishonest, greedy, or ignorant friars and monks in his stories. At the age of 45, Chaucer wrote Troilus and Cressida, which is considered the finest of all medieval romances and is regarded by some people as an even better work than that of Canterbury Tales. Shakespeare based his play Troilus and Cressida on Chaucer's poem 300 years later. Chaucer's version contains 5 books and a total of 8,200 lines of verse. Taken from a tale that dates to the time of Homer, it tells the story of a Trojan prince and his tragic love affair. Cressida is the widowed daughter of a priest who is sent to join her father in the Greek camp outside Troy. Despite her promise to return to Troilus, she gives her love to a Greek soldier, and Troilus, left in despair, is killed in the war. At the end of the poem, Troilus rises to heaven, where he sees the folly of romantic love when compared to the eternal love of God. Chaucer took about 1/3 of his story from the Italian writer Boccaccio, but he infused it with such warmth and tenderness, and his poetry was so exquisite, that the story was given an entirely new life. In the poem, Chaucer deeply analyzes human character and motives and powerfully expresses the misery of the human condition in a way unsurpassed until his admirer Shakespeare came along. His characters are in the classic dilemma of having noble but self-serving motives that run into tragic conflict with fate or the will of God. At the end of his poem, Chaucer urges all young people to love Jesus, who alone is false to no one, and he himself calls on the 1 in 3 and 3 in 1 of the Holy Trinity. The 14th century in which Chaucer lived was a religious and strongly Catholic era. Although some church reformers had appeared, their influence hadn't yet reached the broad population, and especially not the upper class to which Chaucer belonged. Chaucer was a devout Christian, and much of his writing is pious in nature, although it's not his religious work, but his worldly work for which he's most remembered. Besides being a literate poet, he was a man who got around a lot. Chaucer had broad experiences and familiarity with a variety of people and classes. His descriptions of these experiences and people are what make his tales so amusing, as in Canterbury Tales, started when he was about 47. Canterbury Tales is one of the major poems in world literature and had a profound influence on poets and writers for many centuries after. Chaucer completed only 20 of the 120 tales the 30 pilgrims were to tell, 2 on their way to Canterbury and 2 on their way back, and 4 that he did write are incomplete or interrupted by other stories. All the tales depict the values and attitudes of medieval England toward love, marriage, religion, work, and almost every other aspect of life. The stories are also all different in tone and style, designed to suit the character telling the tale, who might be a friar, a lawyer, a sailor, a carpenter, or a doctor. Some speak in a courtly style, some in allegories, others in racy language or in business-like accounts, and the parson simply delivers his story like a sermon. In adapting his language and perspectives to suit his individual characters, he paved the way for Shakespeare and the Elizabethan dramatist. The book starts with some opening lines which describe spring, and then Chaucer describes each of the pilgrims in brilliant, brief portraits. One of the pilgrims in his book is, of course, he, himself, Geoffrey Chaucer. He portrays himself as a simple fellow who takes everything at face value and tends to judge no one. In between the tales the pilgrims tell are short dramatic scenes and conversations between the travelers, usually involving the guide, the innkeeper. The first story is called The Knight's Tale, and tells of royal cousins, prisoners, who fall in love with the same girl and compete for her in a tournament. The Man of Laws is about the unfortunate adventures of Constance, daughter of the emperor, twice married and twice set adrift by wicked mothers-in-law. The Friar's Tale is about a bailiff who tries to cheat a poor widow, who in turn hands him over to the devil, who escorts him to hell. The Squire's Tale, one of his incomplete stories, is about a woman given a ring by the King of Arabia, which enables her to understand the language of birds. The other tales tell of miracles, alchemists, the wiles of a wicked judge, the adventures of the beautiful wife of a stingy merchant, and three rogues who end up killing each other over their greed for gold. In The Prioress's Tale, Chaucer retells the story of Hugh Lincoln, which had long been known in England in ballad form. Little Hugh is murdered by his enemies for singing Alma Redemptoris Mater, but he continues to sing it after his death, and thus his murderers are brought to justice. In the collection are two tales that Chaucer himself contributes, the stories he shared on the way to Canterbury as part of the bargain with his traveling companions. One is called The Tale of Sir Topas, and pokes fun at current romance books about knight-errantry. The other is The Tale of Melibœus, which is a long debate between a husband and wife on the best way to deal with one's enemies. Through all the stories is the presence of Chaucer the Pilgrim, the poet, the civil servant, the curious observer of human virtue and vice, strengths and weaknesses. Because the characters are all pilgrims, he's able to explore the relationship between human needs and desires and spiritual aspirations. The tales are more than just entertaining and amusing stories with colorful characters. They are always questioning the complexity of the human condition, seeing the humor and the tragedy of life, and searching for the purpose and the most honorable way to live. The Canterbury Tales are mostly written in heroic couplets with spellings and accents that are unfamiliar to us today. As a result, there have been many attempts to translate the book, including a popular one by the 17th century English poet John Dryden, a contemporary of Shakespeare. But the translations, to many, only make it clear that it's best to try and struggle through the originals. As an example, here's some of Chaucer's writing from The Wife of Bath's Tale. But now can no man say none elves mo, for now the great charity and prayers of limitours and other holy frayers, that search in every land and every stream, as thicke as motes to the sunny beam, blessing hallis, chambers, kitchenis, burris, cities, burghs, castles, high turris, thropes, burnes, shipnes, dairies, this maketh that there be no fairies. It's not an easy piece to understand, but here's Dryden's version. For now the swain, returning late, may pass the woods in vain, and never hope to see the nightly train. For priests with prayers and other goodly gear have made the merry goblins disappear. Dryden is far more understandable, but he's also written an entirely new poem based on the same theme as Chaucer's, but with little to remind us of the original. It would seem that anyone with a real interest in the genius and beauty of Geoffrey Chaucer has little choice but to read what he wrote as he wrote it. Because language in England changed after Chaucer's death in 1400, his stories were overlooked for many centuries. But they were always known to scholars and writers, like Shakespeare. And by the 1800s, Chaucer was popularly regarded as one of the greatest poets in English history. The tales are most known for their natural, hearty humor, for their variety, and for Chaucer's tolerant view of men and women. In contrast to many humorists of his time and later, he is never cruel or cynical, always sympathetic, and seems to take genuine delight in people, high or low, good or bad. There is hardly an important figure in English literature who didn't know or draw upon the work of Geoffrey Chaucer. John Milton studied him. Alexander Pope translated him. William Blake illustrated Canterbury Tales. Shakespeare borrowed one of his plots. And Edmund Spenser called him the well of English undefiled. Spenser knew, as others do, that besides his wealth of fascinating characters and stories, Chaucer gave us the very language in which our literature is written, as well as the rhythms of our poetry. But he also gave us a rich, detailed portrait of the people and times in which he lived, a whole cast of characters that ranged from grand knights to earthy housewives. No one knows if Chaucer really journeyed to Canterbury with the 30 pilgrims, whether he made part of the story up, or whether he made up all of it. We also don't know if he ever intended to record all 120 stories or just the best. It's a journey that remains unfinished to this day. But although he and his fellow travelers in the book never reached Canterbury, the writer reached a destination he never could have imagined. He gained fame as the first English poet, the founder of the language of our modern literature, and one of the greatest storytellers of all time. It turned out to be a journey that covered not just 50 miles, but 6 centuries of human history.
This is the end of the session.